Moncrief on News Talk.
Staying with the inauguration, sort of, that inauguration was notable for many reasons, but one is that two of the people who took part have speech impediments, Joe Biden and, as you just heard there, the poet Amanda Gorman. Around 70 million people on this planet have some form of disfluency, and Jonty Claypole at Claypole argues that that shouldn't necessarily be seen as something to be fixed. Jonty is the author of Words Fail Us in Defence of Disfluency, and he joins us now on News Talk. Jonty, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Could you tell us something about your speech impediment, your stammer, and the various ways, the various attitudes when you were growing up there were towards that, and of course to try and fix it?
Yeah, I began to stutter as a child when I was very young, and I was aware, first of all, that I had there was something in my speech that was a problem for adults before I was aware of there being a problem with my speech. But I became aware that there was something about my speech that for teachers and adults was problematic. And then afterwards I became conscious that there were words I couldn't get out that I was stuck on. And I did, from a very young age, a lot of speech therapy for my stutter. And it was always this very, very shameful thing I felt that I did my best to hide from classmates, to hide from friends. And over the years, I learned to build my speech and a lot of my behavior around hiding my stutter. And this is so I became, by the time I was a young adult, I became what is called an interiorized stutterer, which means that I would very rarely be heard to stutter, but I was constantly substituting words, avoiding particular situations, constructing my life around avoiding stuttering.
What kind of situations would you avoid?
So if you talk to anyone who stutters, they will tell you, they will probably tell you that the situation they most feared is as having to read aloud in a school class, and then as an adult having to go around in a group and introduce yourself. So in any, whether it's a work group or a support group, that moment where you have to say your name. And so I would avoid any situation which involved public speaking. When I was first starting to do jobs in television production, I would never make phone calls in an open plan office. I would go outside and use a mobile. So any situation where my speech could be overheard, where I had to speak or where I had to speak publicly.
Did any of the therapies that you were put into, did they work to any degree at all, or it sounds more like you devised your own strategy of avoiding those situations that it might exacerbate the stutter?
I got a lot of benefit from speech therapy. Some people don't. I was very lucky that when I was a boy, I was referred by my doctor to a very progressive avant-garde speech therapy unit in London at the time that took in kids from all over the UK. And what we did then was something called speech modification therapy, where they literally dismantled our speech and we learned to speak from scratch, speaking slowly and running our words together. So that helped me a lot. The other thing was when I last did speech therapy, when I was going through a difficult patch in my early 30s, I did an adult group therapy course for interiorized stutterers. And that therapy was really a form of exposure therapy. And we would be sent out every Wednesday night when we met in pairs to go outside onto the streets of London and walk up to strangers and take it in turns to fake a stutter. So I would go to Holborn Station, stop someone and say, "Excuse me, can you tell me the way to Covent Garden?" And you had to look them in the eyes as you did it. And this was important because normally when you stutter, you you never look somebody in the eyes because you're so ashamed. And it was the first time I'd ever looked anyone in the eyes at the moment of stuttering. And we had to do this week after week after week. And what I found was over those weeks, and I was 33 or 34, for the first time in my life, I suddenly stopped caring so much about stuttering. And that was really important for me because it started me on the road to curiosity that got me thinking about what stuttering is, what it means, how it relates to other speech disorders, and ultimately led me to write this book.
Yeah, and I suppose the shame that you refer to there is obviously to some degree a societal factor in that, you know, and people who don't have stutters, who are in conversation with people with stutters, always have that urge to finish words for them, to finish sentences for them, to somehow help them, whereas their attitude might be, I don't need help, I'm just speaking the way I'm speaking.
Yeah, and a golden tip is never to complete the words a person who has a stutter is trying to say. But there was a very famous speech therapist in the 1930s in the American Midwest called Wendell Johnson, who famously said that stuttering begins in the ears of a hearer, not in the mouth of a speaker. So that's to say that it's how people react to stuttering that defines it for the person who stutters, not necessarily the physical act of stuttering itself.
Mm. And because we don't really know why it is some people stutter and some people don't, there seems to be, if you trace it back, and you do in your book, 19th century psychoanalysis has a lot to answer for in terms of what its explanations for it were.
Yeah, I got... As I got into the history of how speech disorders have been treated, psychoanalysis does not come out of it well. And there was, in the early 20th century, there was a lot of speculative psychoanalytical theorizing that claimed that the act of stuttering was symbolic or representative of the sphincter muscles retaining feces, and therefore a sign of anal retentiveness, a sign of homosexuality, a sign of repression and anger. They also said that the vocal tics of Tourette's syndrome were a symbolic representation of the desire to masturbate. Sorry, it's a bit early in the afternoon for this stuff.
No, that's all right. That's fine. They're used to it, our audience.
But these sorts of comments became mainstreamed and affected the way that society at large thought about speech disorders. So when I was 13, about 1988, this was the time when you had Ronnie Barker stuttering to great comic effect in Open All Hours. You had Michael Palin stuttering in A Fish Called Wanda. You had the stutter rap in the top 10. And all of these were very derogatory representations of stuttering because it was seen to be fair game. It was seen to be a sign of, you know, some psychological kind of indulgence or weakness, and therefore fair game. So it was really toxic, the kind of Freudian legacy. And it effectively stopped about 100 years of progress in our understanding of speech disorders.
And going back to what you were saying about the person hears the stutter rather than the other way around. So is your argument a bit like, say, for people on the autism spectrum, that now we use terms like neurodiversity, that there's diversity in the way people verbally express themselves?
Yeah, and neurodiversity is something I write about in the book, that my belief is that people who have speech disorders experience language in a fundamentally different way to people who don't. So language, for people like me, language is something you grow up not seeing as a tool or a way of communicating. It's something you grow up afraid of. And that's a very different way of receiving language. So one of the things I do in the book is that I look at the long and extraordinary history of amazing writers and artists and songwriters who have had stutters and other speech disorders, who have become incredibly verbally linguistic and talented and creative as a result. So to take one example from Ireland, Colm Tobin, who I spoke to for the book, had a severe stutter as a child. And he said to me that the fact he had a stutter drew him to writing, because the ability to release words on paper was so pleasurable, he couldn't not write.
That's so interesting. And is there any correlation there between people who might have a speech impediment and the way they write a language?
Yeah. So if you my belief is that if you have a the general perception is that somebody who has a stutter or a speech impediment is not very good with language and doesn't have many words because they're not getting many words out. In fact, the opposite happens. If you have a stutter, you learn thousands of words because you always want a synonym or an alternative word you can draw on at any given point. So I believe a couple of things. By looking at writers who stuttered, like Lewis Carroll and Henry James and Somerset Maugham, but I believe that I believe that stuttering creates a form of sort of graphomania, which is a desire to write. And Henry James and Lewis Carroll were extraordinary prolific writers. I think it also leads to a tendency to experiment with words, to kind of play with words in unusual ways, in the ways that those writers did. So I also think there's a particular type of creativity which comes from stuttering, which is both a kind of love of language, but a slight irreverence and desire to play with it, because it's been so difficult for you in your daily life.
And it should be said that your book doesn't just deal with people with stutterers, but say with people with Tourette's and other conditions as well.
That's right. So one of the points that I want to make is that these conditions are not minority things that only a few people have, and therefore we don't have to worry about. Statistically, about 20% of the population at some point in their life has a pathological or diagnosable disorder of language or communication. So that can be aphasia, which is very common after a stroke. It can be dysarthria, which is the speech we associate with people who have cerebral palsy or motor neurone disease. It may be the vocal tics of Tourette's syndrome, and it may be stutters. Now, if 20% of the population will have one of those at some point in their lives, perhaps having a stutter or vocal tics as a child, or having aphasia following a stroke later on, or any of the other speech disorders, that means that all of us either have someone in our lives close to us or are ourselves somebody who is going to struggle with speech and communication at some point. And so we need to start understanding this, because it's agony. If you're in that place, it can be a very lonely place to be. So we all have something at stake in understanding these things better and being more sympathetic towards them.
I have interviewed people here before. There's one person I can think of who interviewed who has a stutter and had a stutter in school. It was very hard for him, and then went into journalism, almost in a kind of a bloody-minded way, because that's probably the one thing that his parents didn't want him to do. Did you perhaps have a similar attitude, seeing that, you know, you went into television production and a kind of a profession where you would have to go up and introduce yourself to people?
Yeah, it was different because I went behind the scenes deliberately. So I've always been in production, and I've done the thing that your teams do, developing stories behind the scenes, pressing the buttons and making things happen. And so, but it took me a long time. But a few years ago, I had a revelation in that I thought, I've basically spent my adult life being a linguistic groupie. So I've been very drawn to people who speak fluently and brilliantly, and wanted to work to help those people do what they do. And as I began to look at my own speech, I began to realize that this was probably a consequence of my own difficulties with language, that therefore the sound of somebody speaking effortlessly and fluently was a kind of magic to me that I wanted to be around.
This being Ireland, John T, if you know anything about Ireland, it's that everybody knows everybody. One of our listeners, Mike D, has texted in to say, I worked with John T on a TV show many years ago. We spoke quite a bit. I never noticed a thing about his speech, only that he spoke beautifully. So that kind of proves your point, you know, in a kind of a roundabout way. John T, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Moncrief on News Talk.